museum had lost its charm. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed.
But suddenly I saw you there, and through foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere. And through foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere.
Good afternoon, you're listening to The London Ear on Resonance 104.4 FM. My name's Ben Thompson, and I'm welcoming Resonance Royalty to the studio today. Mr. Stuart Lee, thank you
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for coming in these inclement conditions. What we're hoping not to do today is replicate the atmosphere when Michael Parkinson returned to appear on Paul O'Grady's show on ITV.
Yeah, that was awkward, wasn't it?
It was very awkward, awkward. That, yeah. This is going to be completely different to that. I feel confident. And to prove how different it's going to be, let's start with this. Now we're starting. Any minute now.
Good evening. My name's Ted Chiffington, top entertainer. Come a long way tonight. Good to get a bit of applause at the beginning of the evening, I reckon. Appreciate a bit of applause, I do. Anyway, get on with the joke, I reckon. I think you could appreciate a joke, you know, a bit of a light-hearted evening tonight. So we'll tell you this joke. I was walking down this road the other day. You could say that, but it's not that one, so don't bother. I was walking down this road and this long-haired chap comes up to me. He said, do you want some LSD, man? I said, don't be stupid, mate. We've gone decimal now, you know. Pounds, shillings and pence, no good to me no more. 1967, a good year. But not anymore. You know, you've heard that story once or twice. And you'll hear it again in the future. But it's a good story. Anyway, another joke. Fancy another joke? A joke, well, here we go then. I was walking down this road the other day. As a mate of mine comes up to me. He said, you doing all right, mate? I said, not so bad, actually, mate. He said, I said, I feel like a horse, in fact. He said, feel like a horse? I said, ah, champion. Wasn't feeling too bad that day. Anyway, get on with the number. Haven't got much time tonight, you know, so we'll get on with the... A top entertainment number, this one, D-I-S-C-O. You should like it. Here we go.
Unreal City. Under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and infrequent, were exhaled. And each man fixed his eyes before his feet. Flowed up the hill and down King William Street, to where St. Mary Woolnoth kept the hours with a dead sound on the final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him, crying, Stetson, you who were with me in the ships at Mylae, that corpse you planted last year in your garden, has it begun to sprout? Will it bloom this year, or has a sudden frost disturbed its bed? Oh, keep the dog far hence that's friend to men, or with his nails he'll dig it up again. You, hypocrite lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère.
Yes, Elliot's French accent, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they're different but the same, those things, for me.
Well, I hope they would be that. I thought we'd define the parameters of the afternoon with the great poet Ted Chippington and also some T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously nice on Borough High Street to be listening to people talking about King William Street.
Cause I know, it's amazing. It seems very, well, very resonant. That first... you know, that single you just played, you know, I was in that, I was in the audience when that was recorded, and I can remember it incredibly vividly, that seeing Ted Chippington for the first time. I hadn't expected to see him. I'd gone along to see The Fall, who he was opening for. I didn't know who he was, and I'd seen, you know, I'd seen the two Ronnies live and, you know, bits of stand-up on telly and whatever, but I'd never seen anything like that. And, you can probably imagine from that how amazing it was. This is nearly three decades ago now, and there wasn't really anyone doing anything like that, where he didn't seem to really care what happened in that room. It was very exciting. And he seemed to deliberately make it worse than it was. And in fact, listening to it now, in the midst of doing a long run of stand-up myself, I can see even more clearly all the things I've copied from it. You know, I mean, there's loads of extraneous, irrelevant detail, and the jokes themselves are incredibly slender. You know, and you can guess them. So what's funny about it is everything that's sort of around it. I mean, I think it's absolutely hilarious, and people have accused me of. You know, Frank Skinner said, "I can't see what you're seeing it." And you know, Arthur Smith, I think, thought that I liked it as some kind of, you know, situationist affectation. But I think it is so funny. Still, I still think that is one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
Like all the best situationist affectations, it's deadly serious, isn't it? If you were there in the room. Feeling how badly it was going, how much he was doing it to make it worse. I mean, presumably when you're in the middle of a long theatrical run yourself, being delighted by someone deliberately doing everything they can to make an audience hate them is quite a dangerous thing to be listening to, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but also it's sort of how you keep things alive, I think, for me as a stand-up anyway. It's sort of to make problems.
To sort of lose people and then get them back.
To make problems where there aren't any. And it's the same as jugglers do, where, you know, a good juggler has to drop a plate at the top of the evening, otherwise the audience aren't interested. Because there's nothing exciting about, you know, I don't think, about a definite success. I mean, I read loads and loads of comic books, right? But I never got into Superman. I think it's because he's invulnerable.
Easy. It was, you know, too easy for him.
Where's the jeopardy? You know, unless someone turns up with some kryptonite, he's basically, you know, there doesn't seem to be much point in it to me.
This is the lesson Michael McIntyre needs to learn, isn't it?
Yeah, he needs a kryptonite-like substance to be introduced. Yeah, but I think that is... I think that single, you know, that's a 33 rest per minute, 7-inch single that of the whole of the gig Ted did that night. I think it's about half an hour in total. It's sort of, to me, it's a little holy grail of comedy.
Well, that I'm glad we were able. Let's hope we're not going to sink too far downhill. We started with the Holy Grail. We'll see where else we can get. Now, one of the reasons that I played the T.S. Eliot excerpt, apart from the fact that it sounds very nice, is that your marvellous book, How I Escaped My Certain Fate, you jokingly, I think, in the early stages of this book's production, said you were picking up the baton of T.S. Eliot's Annotated the Wastelands. And I was delighted to see a journalist from The Observer, not renowned for his sense of humour, relaying this gag as if you'd meant it in all seriousness.
I didn't mean it in all seriousness, but I did up to a point, in as much as I thought one of the reasons I wanted to do the book with Faber was because, you know, in my experience, there's always something to be had about the jeopardy between highbrow and lowbrow, you know. And like when we did Jerry Springer the Opera, which I co-wrote the words for, at the National Theatre, it was really funny to be doing this idiotic thing in the Temple of Culture. When it went to the West End, the basic premise of it didn't seem as funny because there's rubbish on in the West End all the time. So it wasn't that amazing to go and do something superficially
perhaps not creative, you know, for the creators of the show. But for, I mean, I remember seeing it, I was in the audience at it's the theatre that Chicago's at.
Yeah,
I wasn't
at
that. And it was a very, the sort of, it's kind of like seeing a band at the O2 Arena, the debasedness of the corporate leisure experience played off the contents.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. You know, it's very kind of you to say. But I did think there was something to be said for the framing effect of passing through the doors of the Temple of Culture at the National Theatre. And the reason I wanted to do the book at Faber, which, you know, is they can't throw the money at you that all the sort of big publishers can, the people that are putting out funny comedy books for Christmas. And what they have got is, if you're doing a book about stand-up where you sort of dare to take stand-up seriously and annotate your own scripts as if they were that famous Faber edition of The Wasteland, where there's the flip side of the page is all pounds edits and whatever, to do it at Faber is extra funny, I think, because it's sort of, what if you did a book through Faber and Faber, the poetry literature publisher, about loads of jokes, right? And and then I did do it, and it did seem to me to make it funnier.
That dream was realised.
Yeah.
While we ponder that happy turn of events, let's listen to some John Cage, but only a little bit, 47 seconds worth to be precise. I think he's finished. That was quick. That was Prelude 2 from The Seasons for Lincoln Kirstein, played by Herbert Henk from the album John Cage, Early Piano Music. And the reason I played it, apart from that it sounds very pretty, is that there's a very nice quote in your book, which I have forgotten the exactness of it, but it's something where perhaps you can remember.
Yeah, well, I can't remember the exact quote, but I learned it's actually from Indeterminacy, Cage's performance piece of lots of short 1 minute long text that he once read, and it's where he says something along the lines of, if something seems boring for a minute, try it for 2 minutes. If it seems boring for 2 minutes, try it for four. If it seems boring for four, try it for eight. And then he works his way up to, you know, try it for 2 hours. If it still seems boring at 2 hours, it probably is boring. And without knowing anything about Cage, it's only in the last 8 months really that I've had any real knowledge of Cage. I sort of was following that.
You've been doing that for years, haven't you?
Yeah, stand up. I mean, and I think it's from Ted Chippington. I think there's something about persisting with something sort of beyond the point where it was reasonable to do so that it becomes hilarious. I mean, and it not always, but usually. And Julian Crouch is very good on this. He was the co-director and sort of designer for Joe Springer, the opera. He's from the Improbable Theatre Group, who do a lot of improv stuff. And I'd be always wanting to cut stuff from the show. And Richard Thomas, a composer, would be wanting to cut stuff. And Gina would go, well, try it more. Before you cut it, try it more. And the answer might be that it needs to be longer. And there's this hilarious bit on the Ted Chippington album, and it's not on that single, on Man in a Suitcase, where he's being heckled. And the audience are going, who the hell are you? Who the hell are you? Who the hell are you? And he just goes, I'm Ted Chippington. And then they do it again. he waits for the whole chant to go all the way through. And he goes, I'm Ted Chippington. And then he goes, the whole chant goes through the whole time again. And he goes, I'm Ted Chippington for the third time. I think where comedy's concerned, right, we sort of live in a culture that prizes the punchy one-liner in the panel show or the set that can be chopped down for 7 minutes for Michael McIntyre's Roadshow or for 3.5 minutes for a guest spot on something else. And I kind of think, in a way, how did you find yourself as not being that? And the answer might be to do things that wouldn't fit any format so that you have to come and see them on their own terms.
And when you mentioned John Cage, and were you involved in a live performance of those?
Well, I've been recently. Steve Beresford, the pianist and composer, and Tanya Chen, who's the same, wanted to do a performance of this piece, Indeterminacy, by John Cage, and there's a spoken word bit in it, and they got me to do it, and it's an absolutely fascinating thing to do. And we're doing it again next year in Reading, Bristol, Bexhill-on-Sea, Cheltenham probably, and at the Royal Festival Hall at the end of May.
And what is actually involved?
Well, Indeterminacy is 91-minute stories that Cage wrote on pieces of card. They're printed up on pieces of card in a box. And there's guidelines on each one about how to get the story within a minute, right? There's little annotations on the side. And some of them are 20 words and some of them are 300 words. And then you shuffle them all up and you can do either 30, 60 or 90. Meanwhile, it was David Tudor originally, but the musician or musicians have to play, ideally in a separate room where they can't hear you, but we didn't do that. They have to play whatever they want, but they're charged by Cage not to respond to the to the things. And the thing about it, what is superb about it, really, really made me think about comedy, and I'm so grateful to Steve and Tanya for giving me the opportunity to do this, was that you start to try and make a narrative out of it in your head, you know what I mean? Like, even some of the things are about collecting mushrooms, some of the things are about artistic theory, others are about very trivial things in Cage's life, or stories where he was on ships trying to get a cigarette or whatever. They're all different kinds of things. But you start to read, you can't help but... The last one, whether it's half an hour or 90 minutes, always feels like it means something.
It really leaves.
Whatever it is. I mean, it's absolutely tremendous. And also, his instructions are also that you have to perform them in such a way as you don't add more emotional weight to one than to another. Whether it's about someone dying or whether it's about... picking up a mushroom, you have to like do them all the same. And again, with comedy, that's something I try to make the audience decide what they think of it and not help them. And actually, you know, doing the Cage thing, even though I've only done it three times so far, but it's been a tremendous help, and also really emboldening, in like just not scared of, even less scared of silences than before. And also that when we did it twice in a church, and people were very, oh, this is very serious. We did it once at the Vortex Jazz Club at like 12:30 at night, and it had a much more like a club atmosphere, and there were people there really laughing at it, which again makes you think it's about context, and is it presented as a piece of entertainment, or is it presented as art? And again, going back to that Ted Chippington thing, what is so funny about that is the way he keeps telling the audience that it is a light-hearted evening, and that it is comedy, and now I will do a joke, and they're not really doing that.
do you think what doing that Cage thing would teach you, if it can be boiled down to one message, is the resourcefulness of the human mind in finding meaning where none exists?
Yeah, and also in joining the gaps, you know, and filling the gaps in and trying to sort of, like, basically he explicitly tries to create an entirely random structure, but we, the viewer, the listener, we try to sort it into something. And I think, you know, you can have fun with that. Like, with stand-up, what I try to do is tell them at the beginning what I'm going to do and where the things are, and then hopefully not finish things off and leave gaps and let the audience do it themselves. And where the fun happens is sometimes when you get half an audience that are really on your wavelength and they're anticipating all the jokes, and the other half never really get on board at all. You know, I don't like that happening to people that have paid to see me. I feel it's not fair, but... sometimes when it happens in more public spaces, I quite enjoy it.
That sort of tension can then becomes a sort of third story or over the top of everything you're saying. As well as the randomness of it is, I don't know, there's an idea that the huge number of possible connections between the stories are actually, you know, either you can sort of look at it slightly cynically and think, well, aren't we humans silly, we try and put meaning where there is none, or you can say, wow, there are so many different layers of meaning that there'll always be
something.
A psychic saying, you know, if you call out for enough people called Janet that have recently lost a pet, there will be someone probably in the crowd.
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, it is exactly that, not neuro-linguistic programming, you know, up to a point as well. Being a stand-up is about trying to control those connections. Again, what I admire hugely about that Ted Chippington record, and I don't know to what extent he was even consciously doing it, is the fact that he basically takes out everything that could get laughs. There's no charisma, there's not really any timing, and the jokes aren't really very funny. But he's still supposed to be a comedian.
It's a
right?
hard bar to get over, that one, isn't it, for the people that followed him, you know? But you're giving it your best.
But it is funny, you know. Why is it still funny?
It is funny. What we're going to hear now, talking of neuro-linguistic programming, we're going to hear a selection from On the Hour.
Right.
And I think this, hopefully most of this will be a selection that you wrote. But we've had the timings are in different order on the screen that I'm looking at. So there's a random element too, but I'm sure. And there's a siren in the background come to take away Chris Morris's ghost. Let's see if this is in the right place. I'm reasonably confident that it is.
Visit Wild Worm Arena World and the hilarious French Revolution Worm Diorama. Our tame worms are tossed towards your hands by trained volunteers. Probably the largest collection of worms in the West Country. Worm World. Truro 0872 223 5689. You won't have to worm your way in. There's a gate.
Get a life. Hobbies.
This week's hobbyist is Clive Tubman of Hales Owen.
My hobby is that hobby of collecting different sounds of different types upon my audio cassettes that I buy at the shops. A day in my hobby can start as soon as I wake up. Ah, the alarm clock. I'd better tape its sound that it is making. Alarm clock, Friday the 12th of July, 1991. Around midday, I usually go down to the shopping centre, where all my fellow sound collectors gather to collect sounds of things. Shopping centre, 1300 hours, 12th of July.
Morning, Clive.
Ian Dealey's voice.
I've taped some good sounds today, Clive. A prayer moving, a bird, and a stick in the gutter. I made a copy of the stick if you want to trade.
No, I've got lots of stick sounds.
Would it be possible to hear some of your favourite sounds?
Interviewer's voice speaking, 1507. Yes, thank you for asking. They can be heard. They are sounds, after all.
Yeah. No, I mean, can you play some of them to us now?
Oh, all right. Sounds being heard, 1508. This one is the sound of an old woman's face slapping against the windscreen of my speeding car. It was very hard to get. I had to do it 4 or 5 times, and on one of the times, I'd forgotten to switch on my recorder. Do you want to hear it?
No. I actually think we'd better be going.
Bored? Want weekend fun? Strongly disapprove of traffic congestion? Like hats with yellow and black enamel badges on them?
Then the sealed clamp is for you.
Every weekend we meet up.
Mild-mannered comic actor Steve Coogan there.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing that you hit those two bits. That's from a show on the air. And when I first came to London in 1989 with Richard Herring, we sort of pitched up to Radio 4 and tried to write for anything. And it was amazing back then. Like now, a lot of questions are asked. How do we find new talent for radio writing? And what they used to do at Radio 4 was you could just turn up and go to a meeting for new writers and just walk into the BBC without any proof of ID and be shown to this, you know, and inevitably that system, they did find people, but you couldn't do that now. It was a very different world. And that was a show we ended up writing for called On the Air, which was the first thing for Coogan, Steve Coogan and Patrick Marber and Chris Morris and Armando Iannucci, and it ended up being the day-to-day on television, and Alan Partridge came out of it. And weirdly, those two bits were very specifically things that me and Richard Herring wrote, which is a bit of luck that you stumbled into them. Worm World, which is an advert for a place where you could go and see worms. I remember waking up in the middle of the night in the flat I lived in Fulham, just near Putney Bridge, and writing that all down in like in 10 minutes.
It's a dream. It's
waking
ultimate.
Up, waking up, yeah. Out of a dream, yeah. And you know, and that was what it was. When I was like 20, 21, 22, I'd carry a notebook around me everywhere by my bed, and I'd wake up and write it down. And now I don't really have that kind of mind anymore. I'm too tired all the time, and I work stuff out on stage. But that arrived literally fully formed in a kind of weird dream. That being about
we won't subject the dream about Worm World to Freudian analysis. We won't do that.
And then the other bit, me and Rich wrote that, is about a man who's obsessed with collecting sounds. He wants to collect every sound in the world, and it's sort of from two or three things. One is I've been doing a gig in Doncaster, and a stand-up gig, and there was guys there audio taping every train that went through, every single piece, and as it went through, calling into their dictaphones the numbers of each individual piece of rolling stock, right? Not just the train itself, every piece of rolling stock was numbered. And these were people that wanted to, during the course of their lives, basically see and annotate every piece of rolling stock that was on a British railway. It was like beyond train spotting. There's something quite heroic about it, I thought. It's also sort of based on the kind of people you used to meet at free improv gigs in the 80s that, and I completely understand that mentality now, which is that this is only going to happen once. It's never going to be repeated. It's improvisation. So they'd kind of want to get everything, you know.
I guess that in the digital age, when everything can be reproduced so endlessly, yeah, that it becomes quite something that is especially alluring, the idea of something that can only happen once.
Yeah. And the other thing, it was based on a kind of a fanzine editor who used to put out, I think it was called Nicholas something, and he used to put out inky photocopied fanzines about very specific people, like Julie, something Benjamin her name was. She was an actress in a a BSB space soap opera called Jupiter Moon. And it was full of just every single fact about her. And I thought it's really... And it wasn't really meant to be making fun of them. It was more like there's something amazing about that kind of mind. And so that character was someone who wanted to have a recording of what every possible sound in the world would be like. And, of course, that character sort of developed into this character, Simon Quinlang, that we ended up doing on the television, who was the hobbyist, played by Kevin Eldon, who would have hobbies that were... involved the collecting or the noting of things that were so vast that they could never really be done or were oddly specific and had a kind of sadistic bent to them. But, I mean, it was amazing to hear that again, and both those two things, the essence of so much of what we went on to do is in them. And it's also interesting to see them because our agent had a dispute on our behalf with On The Air when it went to television about who'd invented different characters, and so everything we did that we wrote specifically got edited out of the initial re-release of the radio show. So those jumping up like that is amazing.
I especially like the gentle irony of the fact that a character who wanted a recording of every sound ever made was erased from history by the agents of the people who created him.
That's a really interesting thought. Yeah.
And now he's back. And he's probably got a show on Resonance as well sometime.
You know, it's not unlike someone like Peter Cusack or someone. I don't know if you know him. You know, I think that's his name. And like those, and Chris Cutler made a couple of amazing albums of. He got people all around the world to record things at the same time there in their time zone every day. And I mean, they are very interesting, I think. And actually, sometimes maybe what you're doing with comedy is you're not really making fun of things. You're sort of creating something you'd actually quite like to hear or see.
It doesn't exist, but it'd be lovely if it did. Yeah. Let's have a bit of music now. Mission of Burma, and we'll have to call this the title track if a book can have a title track. This is the title track of your book. That you've taken the word, have you taken the first word off that?
Yeah, I took that off.
Did you check that with Mission of Burma, or did you
I didn't ask Mission of Burma, and I wish I had done now. It's probably should have done.
Well, let's hope the consequences, you know,
don't haunt
us all. Mission of Burma.
That's how I escaped my certain fate. This might be your only chance.
Am I right in thinking that you performed that song live on stage with the Beat combo, Franz Ferdinand?
I did, yeah. I got asked to put together a show to launch my book, which is called How I Escaped My Certain Fate, in Edinburgh by Faber and Faber during the summer. So, and you know, I thought we should have a big guest, special guest, really, you know, that'd be a surprise. And about 4 weeks before, I got interviewed by Alex, the singer from Franz Ferdinand for Scottish Radio. He does arts journalism for them, and it turned out he'd been going to see us for years. And I went, Well, you don't fancy playing in this thing, do you? I just thought I'd ask, you know, because that's like the most famous person I'd ever met, really. And
oh, come on.
Well, you know, and they said they'd do it, and they were superb, actually. There were a number of things that were really good about it. First of all, they said, that, well, we'll learn that and you can sing it, which was a bit like fat middle-aged man karaoke, but I got away with it. They did. They backed Kevin Eldon, the actor Kevin Eldon. Did, he was this character on a show called Look Around You, where he was supposed to be a man in the 80s singing a song from the future, Macadamia, it was called. And it's become like a rock band in joke, and lots of them cover it. Wilco do it, and so Franz Ferdinand did that while he sang. But they also did like two of their hits through amps, not through a mixing desk, on the stage of a, for them, comparatively small Edinburgh theatre. And it really made me think what it would have been like seeing the Kinks or the Beatles or something, you know, in those provincial theatres in the mid-60s. It sounded fantastic, and it reminded you that these big rock bands that you're used to hearing through, through, you know, massive digital PAs in rock festivals, they can really do it. You know, it's just, you don't often get to hear what it actually sounds like, you know, so it was superb.
In terms of Mission of Burma, obviously they're one of many bands from that period, and it also sort of connects with Ted Chippington as well, who have reappeared to a greater or lesser extent in recent years. And I wondered how do you, I think I've probably seen you standing in the crowd happily at a Mission of Burma show, I wondered if you have rules for the kind of reunions that work for you and the kind that don't. If
it's... Well, you know, it's all different. You can never tell. I mean, it's not like Mission of Burma. It's not that people ever really went away. I mean, Pete Prescott formed Volcano Sons and then Customized, and then they all got Mission of Burma back together, and Roger Miller was making sort of quite avant-garde piano records and stuff. So, but I think the important thing was that they did the old songs, but they made new ones as well, in the same way as Wire did, and it wasn't embarrassing. It depends if you're the kind of band where it was about the excitement and naivety of youth, you know, and whether you can carry it off. I remember when Television reformed in about 92, I found it astonishing. I couldn't believe that you'd get to see them. You know, they must have been all of 37 by then, and it seemed astonishing that they could come back.
That a man could even go on stage at that advanced stage.
I know, when you're like 22, you think, wow, granddad. But they had a sort of dignity about them. It didn't matter, you know, because they were always like bookish. Like, yeah. It depends who it is, you know. And I think also, I think with jazz and folk and certain kinds of rock, and certainly with stand-up comedy, bizarrely, there's a sort of gravity to being older that I think really helps it. You know, certainly with The Fall, for example, you know, it's like Marky Smith was a little old man in waiting, and now he is a crazy little old man.
He's fulfilled his destiny.
Bob Dylan seemed to be pretending to be 70 when he was 19.
Yeah.
And now he is, so it sort of suits him, you know.
Well, we're going to hear someone now who you've kindly brought with you this CD. I asked you to bring it because he's someone I've always been fascinated by, the idea of him. He's mentioned in your book. I've never actually heard anything by him. So could give us a brief introduction to Chick Murray, presumably Chick rather than Sheik Murray.
Chick Murray, right. I came to Chick Murray by a strange circuitous route. In the mid-90s, I interviewed Derek Bailey, the free jazz guitarist for the Sunday Times, who was astonished to find out that I was a working comic and that I was also doing this kind of journalism on the side. And he said that he'd really liked Chick Murray, and that all the jazzers used to go after their gigs. If Chick Murray was somewhere on the variety circuit, they'd always go and see him, and they thought he was the best. And Derek Bailey, of course, played in a lot of pit bands for Morecambe Wise and people like that in the 50s. And Derek Bailey gave me the first recordings I ever heard of Chick Murray. And then I went away and listened to Chick Murray, and I realised that loads of the people that I liked had obviously been influenced by Chick Murray. Arnold Brown, a lot of the deadpan guys that I liked when I was starting out in the 80s. And it's very hard to find more than half an hour of Chick Murray. I suspect he may have been one of those guys that toured the same half an hour for about 40 years.
Yeah.
But what there is superb. And at Derek Bailey's funeral, his partner who survived him, Karen, asked me if I'd read something, and I read out a bit of a Chick Murray act. And so here is a bit of Chick Murray, the Scottish Music Hall comic.
And what we'll do, because I was going to play it a little bit later, but it seems nice to play them together in reuniting them. We've got a track that you've also bought from the Spontaneous Music Ensemble, featuring Derek Bailey, of course, the album Withdrawal, 1966 to 67. We're going to play, because one track that's 2 minutes long. Which,
yeah, I don't know what it'll be like.
We don't, we don't know what it'll be like, but whatever it's like, it has the advantage of being 2 minutes long, which will be crucial in this context. So first, we're going to hear Chick Murray and The Train Compartment.
A friend, I came by. Thank you very much, Bobby. And I wasn't too sure the words were out, didn't I? Of course, I was. I've sung them. I come back on the train from Gloucester, a common way of travelling. I know I'm not boasting. I mean, there's quite a few in the train with me. It was packed, as a matter of fact, with the airstrike at Glasgow. And an incident happened there. It was a friend of mine who had been at the Ideal Home the Daily Mail Home exhibition at Olympia. And he's a bachelor, lives in his own. Does he? Yes, he does. And he bought himself an ironing table. He wanted one that could sort of compress into a small space and then, you know, extend when he needed to, whatever he does with it, I don't know. And when he got there, he found that the compartment or the sleeper that he had booked had gone, and he had to share a four berth. So there's so many people on the train with this crisis at the airport we have that he just made do, and he made his way up into the top berth, and he put his ironing table, which he had compressed into a small space at the back. And as he idly glanced over at the other bunk on the far side, he noticed it was a female that was there. And she was looking at him. He said, "What's happened to you?" He thought it was, oh, she said, "It's been a dreadful." She said, "I had a first-class sleeper, but the way things are," she said, "I'm just so pleased to get in here." So he doesn't waste a minute there. So he said, "Come on over, have a share a cigarette with me." Oh, she said, "Don't be silly. I don't even know you." He said, "Don't let that worry you." She said, "Even though I did want to come over to your bunk," she said, "I couldn't manage it." She said, "I disturbed the occupants in the bunks downstairs, and I don't know where that silly little ladder's gone to." He said, "You don't need that silly little ladder," he said. "I've got something here that could stretch over to your bunk." "And you could walk across." So a voice below said, "I don't believe it." "And anyway, how's she going to get back?"
I love that little grunt he makes at the end there. It wasn't our intention to play a risque thing. In fact, what I was going to do was go straight into the Spontaneous Music Ensemble, and I forgot. So let's do that right now, and that will seem, hopefully, very, very spontaneous. Thank you. I love it when Joe Loss comes in over the top.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's funny how you can hear that they, you can hear their backgrounds in sort of British jazz. You know, when they hit that little bit together, you sort of think, oh, it's about to start swinging now. You know,
for me, that's what I most enjoy, that moment. Yeah. You know, and it sort of the possibility that it might start swinging.
Yeah.
Withdrawal sequence. Then they withdraw the possibility.
Yeah.
They withdraw that possibility. Withdrawal sequence 3C4 in brackets. I don't know what that means, but it's very nice as a title. Spontaneous Music Ensemble, and before that we heard Chick Murray being a little bit...
It was uncharacteristically blue, that.
A bit saucy for daytime radio.
Yeah, he
normally
bangs out the funny one-liners, you know, I don't know, it, the wrong bit.
It still worked. It was my fault, because I wanted something that lasted 2 minutes, 15 seconds.
Yeah, well, that's what you get.
I had intended to bring a Spike Milligan spoken word album with me, which I sadly left at home, but we're running out of time anyway, so it's probably for the best. But I suppose in a way he and his mates were the beginning of the jazz comedy cross. I mean, not the beginning, but they started.
Who's that?
Spike Milligan.
Oh, yeah.
And they started the idea of a jazz comedy crossover, didn't they, in a way? I mean, because they were all in wartime bands and everything, weren't they? And for them it was sort of, it was just obvious that those two things went together.
Also, you know, across the Atlantic with Lenny Bruce. I mean, Lenny Bruce's quote, you know, his phrase, he said, you know, I could always make the band laugh. And I think that it was sort of, they were playing to other artists almost, you know, almost over the heads of the audience, to the people that had seen it a lot, you know, to try and make them laugh. And I kind of think that's a problem. If there's a problem with the comedy I do, it's that I'm... And the acts that I like, it's often that the people laughing are the 10 comics at the back of the room. But then I think eventually that creeps forwards, you know, and you start to get the audience to laugh at the things that comedians like, you know, and the things that comedians like stuff. Comedians can, you know, admire the well-executed things that everyone likes, but they also like the things that the public are still catching up with or, you know, will never relate to.
But also, I mean, I think it seems to me that one thing that you've done very productively in your career is you've used the capacity for tension in a new situation that you might find yourself in, like with the TV show. The most recent TV show, I very much enjoyed the way you played off the feelings of the viewer at home against the feelings of the live audience.
Yeah.
But where most comedians would prioritise the needs of the, you know, 1.5 million viewers at home, you prioritise the needs of the 150 people in the room.
I think I think that, you know, there's a button on my telly that I get through Virgin. Am I allowed to say that? Anyway, it says TV on demand, right? And you can go and you can get what you demand immediately. And everything's like on demand now. And I kind of think a lot of the things that I ended up absolutely loving, I only ended up watching them or listening to them because there was only 3 channels and I was sort of stuck with it, and so I persisted with it. You know, like The Fall, for example, which I love, I'd hear it on Peel all the time as a kid and I didn't like it. But it was there every night.
It's like acquiring the taste of whiskey, isn't it? You've got to give it a few goes. Yeah.
You know, I mean, you kind of...
Or meths.
Well, Al Murray, the pub landlord, has a funny, really funny routine about how when you first drink lager, it's just foul. Mm. You can't understand how your dad has to have it every day. You have to work at these things, you know. And I kind of think with the telly show, I thought everything on telly is now so like, oh, it's for you, it's for the viewer, look at how brilliant.
You've got
thing.
To interact.
You love it. Oh, and use an interactive thing, and it's all, don't worry, it's only 30 seconds long, this bit, and then there'll be another bit. And it's all brightly lit. And I thought, well, one way of being different would be to do the opposite of that, and to do some really long things quietly that don't appear to be for the benefit of the people watching.
What I especially liked about it was the idea that people watching that had maybe only ever watched TV comedy would have thought it was kind of... It's kind of like Facebook in reverse. They'd have seen it and thought, what is this thing from which we're being excluded?
Yeah, well, I noticed that with critics. Like, critics couldn't, initially, the television critics didn't really know how to write about the stand-up. And what I do in stand-up isn't that far away from loads of stand-ups. It's just that it isn't the kind of thing that's on telly. And they thought they knew about stand-up because they've seen stand-up on telly, but that's only, by definition, it can only be a very particular kind, really, that can work on telly. So, you know, I mean, I was really pleased with that. But again, it's about seeing music and the musicians you like. And, like, there's a lot to be said for communicating with an audience. And bizarrely, actually, Derek Bailey was a very good communicator with an audience. He was a very funny man, and he was quite good at telling stories and stuff. But when you watch those guys and when you watch the folkies and the old jazzers and the sort of crotchety post-punks that are now in their 50s, you feel like they're artists who would be doing that work, whatever. And it's a kind of coincidence that it's become like the people go and see it, you know. And I sort of feel with the stand-up, you have to teach the audience their position, which is that I would be saying this.
Show
anyway.
Them who's boss.
I would be saying this anyway, whether it gets laughs or not.
Well, you mentioned Lenny Bruce, and that was very helpful of you, because what we're going to play now is something I only found the other day. I was excited by the idea of it. It possibly works better as an idea, but anyway, let's do it. It's a book called, hang on, let me have a look, The Trials of Lenny Bruce.
Great, that book,
And it has a CD with it, which contains illegally recorded footage, not footage, whatever it is, audio tape of Bruce's trial, which he recorded in his briefcase as a kind of conceptual riposte to the fact.
I haven't listened to this.
To the fact that he hated the presentation, as his one of the key things in the case against Bruce was that they got a policeman who basically went along, noted down all the obscenities, and then would say, you know, obscenity, 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 then some philosophical rubbish.
Yeah, and then you know what Lenny Bruce said about that brilliantly. I mean, well, he was convicted on the performance of this policeman of his material, and he said, "You're busting me for his act."
Exactly.
It's superb.
Exactly.
Which is about, you know, it's about context and intent and who's doing it, and the words are not the same as the performer doing it.
Well, I felt that, you know, from your own experiences of being hounded by the religious right, you probably would have felt Lenny's pain.
Yeah.
What this is, it is recorded in the early 60s, isn't it? Inside a briefcase, and the sonic quality does reflect that. But there's a little introduction first, which hopefully will make everything clear.
The New York version of People v. Bruce came before a 3-judge panel. It was the first criminal prosecution in the history of New York over words spoken in a nightclub. In this misdemeanor case, the state called 12 witnesses and the defense called 18. One of the expert witnesses for the defense was Richard Gilman, a literary critic for Newsweek, who testified to the artistic integrity and social significance of Lenny's act. Richard Q., the formidable assistant district attorney who prosecuted the New York case, cross-examined Gilman, hoping to prove Lenny's controversial routines were obscure, incoherent, and, quote, filth for filth's sake. Unknown to Q and the court, Lenny secretly taped the proceedings with a portable reel-to-reel tape recorder he had installed in his briefcase. This never-before-released excerpt from those tapes captures a portion of a particularly heated exchange between Q and Gilman, with Lenny's attorney, Ephraim London, objecting.
You spoke of the pissing in the sink incident as a urinary phenomenon. We would quote you accurately, but not a urinary phenomenon, but a sociological and psychological phenomenon. Do I quote you correctly? Yeah. And then you continued, I believe, saying, you said sociological and psychological phenomenon, that Bruce was referring to bad health. Is that correct? The lack of bad.
That isn't correct. I added that as a possibility.
You did add it as a possibility.
Yes, I made no...
Not a certain.
I cannot be certain of anything that he says.
Then there is some obscurity about what Bruce says. Is
I thought correct? There would be, because if it was absolutely certain, we knew it would be a mathematical demonstration.
And in terms of the normal performance, is obscurity part of
monitoring? If you state it that way, obviously not. Obscurity may be necessary because of the nature of the material in the world.
Would you say the great words in oral performances that have lived through generations, give me liberty or give me death, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself? Words like this were obscure. Is that part of their glory and their merit?
You may look beautiful now, but in 10 years you're gonna look like a dog.
The future is with me, the future is with me. What's to become of me? What's to become of me?
Surgery!
Dr. Knight!
problems spoil your night. Throw away your diets and use a parasite.
Some people do as they think they should.
Others get Viagra and get wood.
I'm sure it's a delight for you to hear that again. It's lasted well enough, I feel.
Well, Jerry Springer, the opera, I haven't listened to that since I stopped working on it in 2006, I think it was.
And, I mean, were there any point... I mean, before that, we heard the utterly formidable prosecutor, and we sort of heard it, I hope that was audible to people at home, Richard Kuh, K-U-H, I think his name was, making a very formidable case on that. Amongst those secret recordings, there's an excellent one where he quizzes a priest about Bruce's language, and I would have played that, but it wouldn't have been allowed on daytime radio. But the priest makes a very stalwart defence of Lenny's right to say the things that he's been saying. But Richard is not put off in his determination to bring him down. And I mean, did you ever feel yourself to be like a sort of hart, as in H-A-R-T, the sort of medieval stag with the king and the hounds after you, or did it never quite
they
get that bad?
Flee from me that sometime did me seek. Richard Thomas, it was his idea, Jerry Springer, the opera, and he was very clear about one thing, which was that the intent behind the words that are said by the people on a Jerry Springer show could be totally changed or brought or the meaning of it brought forward by the tonality or lack of the music, right? So that often when people were really, really swearing at each other on that programme and using the foulest abuse, they're actually saying, I love you and I'm frustrated about my ability to communicate with you. And the way you bring that forward is with the secret language of music. Of course, you remove the secret language of music and you just take all the words out of context and put them in a newspaper. It doesn't make any sense.
In a way, that is exactly what happened to Lenny Bruce.
That's what happened to that show. I mean, actually, it is really weird. I mean, I was so honoured to have been asked to work on it and really proud of it. But actually, the whole experience, the fallout of it, was so sort of traumatising. You don't really realise. I mean, that is literally the first time I've heard any of it for 5 years now.
You're going to be all right for the rest of the day?
I'm going to be sick. But also, I'd forgotten how good it was. I mean, I can say that without being arrogant as well, because that bit's actually nothing to do with me. I might have written some of the words in that bit, but I can't remember. But certainly the music wasn't. But, it does sound really... It's so delicate, the arrangements of it and everything. The arrangers... Also, I realise in the book, I've been a bit unfair about the arrangers hearing it again. I think it was difficult. They had to... You know, when it was a little fringe show, Jerry Springer, the opera, it was just Richard Thomas on the piano, and then when it got upscaled to commercial theatre, it was a difficult job for the arrangers, you know, the kind of people that go and see a big piece of commercial theatre, they want a big band, they want arrangers, but obviously as soon as you put arrangements on it, you're making choices about the emotional texture of the piece, you know, and I think it was a difficult job for them to negotiate a path towards that. I mean, it also makes me... I always thought, God, I'd never do anything like that again. It became such a huge job coordinating all those people.
But
hearing it again, you sort of think, well, it was interesting. Yeah.
And I'm sure they all remember it fondly. I mean, you kind of have that thing that I guess people in... You know, well, it is upper echelon showbiz that they have, that you have a lot of people that depending on you their livings. Yeah. And so a little creative adjustment that you make or don't make, you know, has enormous ramifications for them. And that presumably, when you've done that for a while, being out on your own with a microphone in front of some angry students seems quite easy, I should imagine.
Much easier, yeah, and more direct. But I mean, you got to think, by the end, you know, they were trying to tour it. They were trying to tour it to claw back the money it had lost in the few towns that would still take it after all the theatres had been threatened by pickets from the BNP and Christian Voice. And in some of the towns, like Leicester, I remember, there was a whole load of bed and breakfast that wouldn't take anyone that was working on the show because they were Satan or something, you know, and it was just... And having to cross picket lines to do it, and then having to go and do public meetings to explain your position to people that just couldn't listen to anything because they were so mad. It was really... it made you a bit of a misanthropist as well. I mean, you met a lot of nasty people, and, you know, it's much better to not do that. And also, you know, the risk of sounding like a breadhead, you know, you couldn't get paid for it. can get paid for it because it was
the
se- because I mean, it was not
the Sex Pistols found that as well when the councils banned them. I mean presumably when you're in terms of the book, I think one of the people that, things that people have enjoyed about it most is the sort of the sense of unfetteredness in the way the things you get off your chest, whether it's about your own craft or other practitioners of it. And presumably there's something, the sort of primal trauma of being trapped in a series of public meetings with people, however sensible a thing you might say would be, people wouldn't take any notice. Presumably it's quite therapeutic.
The best one was in Aberdeen where someone went, "Why have you done this?" And I explained what it was supposed to be about. It took me about 5 minutes. I explained piece by piece what I thought the purpose of the and the meaning of the of Jerry Springer the Opera was. And then the woman went, "Oh, it's all just words with you, isn't it?"
There's not really...
it's an unwinnable situation.
No, there's not really any way out of that, is there? Well, we're coming to the end of our time now, sadly. I've very much enjoyed it, but we should say that your the current live show continues at the Leicester Square Theatre, which is a lovely venue, I must say. It's just downstairs, and you sort of it's just big enough. Well, I hope it's big enough for you, but it's just big enough for the crowd. Everything about it's good, so that's highly recommended. One of the things about your book that is most enjoyable is the explication. Much in the way that Stephen Sondheim, who, like Jay-Z, has copied your methodology, you'll be...
I know, well, you know, people can watch... You can't have a book that's mainly footnotes, but, you know, now they're all doing it.
They're all doing it now. They're all following. Why did Stephen Sondheim come into it? I can't remember.
He's got a lot of footnotes.
He's got a lot of footnotes. Yeah. That is how he came into it. But he also explains... There's some great explanation in his book about masculine and feminine rhyme and for half rhyme, and it's very useful for rappers, that book. Right. But in your book, there's a lot of very useful technical stuff for comedians. And I especially liked the explication of the callback.
Yeah, the callback and reveal. Yeah, the callback and the reincorporation and
Well, so what we're going to do is we're going to have employed John Cage to demonstrate the concept of the comedy callback. We're going to play again, and also his various repetitious ideas. We're going to play again the same song we played at the start by John Cage to see if we can hear anything different in it. Thank you very much, Stuart Lee, for coming in today. It's been a great pleasure. And I hope you're not too traumatised to go on stage tonight when you remember your Jerry Springer experiences.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers.